let me present Exploiting the Hardworking Dwarf, a work by the Dartmouth College Trust Lab with James Oakley, the primary author, and I'm really proud of him getting the Best Student Paper Award. This is great. Thank you, PC. I'm going to give you an executive summary of this effort. The effort is still ongoing. James may or may not participate, having been having graduated and having gotten a real world job. But the key point is that all GCC compiled binaries that support any kind of exception handling, that means both C and C++ binaries, include this quite sophisticated bytecode for describing their exception handling information. And this bytecode is interpreted by the standard library, libcdgcc. When an exception occurs and the stack is unwound and complex structures allocated on the stack and partially in registers are restored, and of course modern compilers can put half of a data structure in the registers, half on the stack, so this is required if you want to support all sorts of compiler optimizations. So what this comes down to is that this information is interpreted by nothing less than a full stack machine with arithmetic branches and just about any other thing you would want of a Turing machine. You can perform almost any computation on it, and this will work on any system that does exception handling, that supports exception handling for at least one component of the target's address space. Now, just to dismiss one bit of common misunderstanding, this is not about debugging at all. The Dwarf format was invented for debugging. However, this will work with dynamically linked executables without any sort of debugging information, totally stripped. What I'm going to demonstrate is a Trojan backdoor technique and tools for programming almost arbitrary computations in that Trojan mechanism. We're not presenting a full memory corruption exploit by itself. That work may follow. Also, mitigation work is underway. And we are presenting a collection of tools with which interested parties can play with this mechanism. This mechanism is ubiquitous. It needs to be much better understood. Developers must understand what they are generating every time they compile anything in C or C++. To dismiss another bit of understanding, this is not structured exception handling. Unix exceptions work differently from Windows exceptions. So if you're thinking that this is an elaboration on SEH overwriting, it's not. This project extends a long line of hacker research. The ERESI project was the primary inspiration. The dynamic linker exploitation techniques, the next two papers you're seeing on the screen, have borrowed large parts or all of the dynamic linker to accomplish their goals, their attack goals. And the LawCreate, published in uninformed.org, is a wonderful example of how you can take an automaton already present in the target's memory, in that particular case, a relocation automaton, and by giving it nothing more than valid data for that automaton, do a task such as packing or unpacking a piece of code that you do not want to be obvious to static analysis. So I urge you to look up LawCreate and the corresponding hacker development, hacker research vein. I find it very significant. So Dwarf, as the debugging format, as the exception handling format, allows us to create a Trojan payload. And that Trojan payload would not contain anything that looks like a native target's binary code. So for one reason or another, antiviruses we checked simply skip over the data. They do not try to interpret it any way. When we put a known virus signature into it, they ignore it. So no one wants to mess with Dwarf. This can go much further. When you manage to get that code into your address space, it can work around ASLR in that space. Once, of course, you can sneak it in and get it executed. So the format is so powerful that we wrote our own dynamic linker entirely in Dwarf bytecode, and it can resolve symbols. So that's it. Bring your own linker to the party. So, you know, what can we do with this, right? Now, I'm going to show you a video of the demo, but given my betting average so far, let's just pray to the demo gods. Ah, there we are. Okay. So here we go. Here's a silly little C program that inputs a string. If the input is known, it prints a silly response. Otherwise, it throws an exception. There is nothing sinister about this program so far. See? A couple of stir comps and the throw. And of course, a catch. So there is no exec in it. There aren't any invocations of exec or system, which of course we've seen the code. But let's disassemble everything that's disassemblable in this little demo. So here are those standard else sections and the functions, and then the main and all the little landing pads. And we're going to save that into a file. Again, that's anything that looks remotely executable to objdump. And here is a modified file, which we modified with our tool. The modification is all in the Dwarf exception handling information. And there is nothing different between the native code sections. So we're convinced this program is self to run. Let's suidify it, right? What can it do to us? Throw an exception? So here it is. And let's convince ourselves who we are. That's what we are. We're a user. Now let's cause this program to throw that exception. So what did happen there? How did we get to end up with a root shell on that exception path? There was nothing. There was nothing like a call to anything like exec or system. So let's talk about this a little bit further. And of course, I am a huge fan of Tolkien, and so we're going deeper. You know, we're talking about elves and dwarfs. These are the, let's find the Balrog. First thing to recap, is that the dwarf format was designed as a debugging tool, which means it's there for parsing complex structures and presenting a view of those structures to the debugger. So it needs to know about just about any way you can get an offset into a struct, or you can walk a call frame according to one formatted according to one memory formatting calling convention or another. Which means it was done in such generality to support all the possible languages that GCC would compile that it can perform arbitrary computations. And at the same time, being adopted for stack unwinding and exception handling. It is meant to influence the flow of the program. So this is a very powerful combination. The adaptation of Dwarf to exception handling purposes from its original debugging, that is to say, type and data structure describing purposes, has been gradual. The resulting emergent standard is not identical to the Dwarf specification, and it's not, in fact, a standard. It's entirely at the whim of GCC developers. When you hunt for the data on exception handling specifically, you find a bunch of obsolete postings to GCC development lists with other postings saying that, hey, that posting has a really great explanation, except these parts are no longer true. So go figure that out. The specific sections that we're going to look at are EH frame, where the most of the action is. This is a standard Dwarf section. EH frame header and GCC except table. GCC exception table is GCC specific, not deeply documented, shall we say, and contains C++ specific information in the case of the demo. What these things really are, though, and this is the perspective that is, if you look carefully, quite prevalent in hacker research on the topic, is that there is a virtual machine resident in your memory space at ELF runtime. And that virtual machine interprets the bytecode, that is the EH frame contents. So locate is another example of that with the relocator and the relocation sections in ELF. The CTORS, DTORS, FINI, INI grouping is actually yet another example. So that separation between code and data in your space, supposing you had the Harvard architecture of your choice, this is no longer relevant because, in fact, there are many virtual machines that preside over construction of the ELF address space and many byte codes that these virtual machines execute. And we can program with their power as borrowed power. What EH frame should represent conceptually is a table for each instruction in the program that describes how to restore the state while unwinding the stack in the previous stack frame. So conceptually, this is a giant table that describes the effects of this instruction on each and every register of the architecture, and the so-called canonical frame address, which is what tells you what the frame pointer is for those calling conventions that are built around frame pointer. This is both are convenient Dwarf abstractions, CFA, and the registers. The Dwarf standard stipulates mapping of actual registers, even though here you're seeing EBP, EBX, could be RBP, RAX, and so on and so forth. This is actually encouraged to be by the Dwarf Standard Committee a part of the ABI. So we're looking at a very general way of describing rules for recovering state. Of course, that table would be humongous. So it is stored in compressed form and regenerated on the fly. You only regenerate the right part of it, which you need. This works the same way either for debugging or for exception handling. This is essentially a compression technique. So this is the structure of the EH frame. It consists of the common information entity and frame description entity. Both contain information such as what is the encoding, what is the ID, what is the handler, that is the augmentation part of the CIE, and most importantly, what are the instructions. So think of the instructions in the CIE. There is a CIE per language, usually. There is an FD, frame description entity, for each function. Or it could be per distinguished blocks of your program. It doesn't necessarily need to be a function. So those instructions in the CIA are constructors. Those instructions in the FDEs are those that you execute to recover the appropriate part of the table. Notice the LSDA pointer here in the FDE. This is where the personality routine, the language-specific interpreter, will be pointed to. So originally, Dwarf 1 and Dwarf 2 instructions were pretty simple. They described locations of objects on the stack. So say an offset off of a given register, or an offset off of the CFA. That is to say, an offset into the call stack frame. Or direct register transfers, like the last example, the register one is restored from register two. So that's pretty simple. This is how you locate, this is how you find the address from which you restore a register, the contents of a register. And then, as more languages were added and more functionality was added, it became clear that instead of having specific arithmetic offset operations, it might be useful to have general expressions. General expressions that work on a stack machine and that allow you to, look in the blue frame, to push constants on the stack, const u, const 8s, unsigned, sorry, signed 8-bit address, then allow you to add them, plus multiplications, bitwise operations. Then, having come up with an address, dereference it, which consumes the address on top of the stack and actually replaces it with the contents of a memory word pointed to by that address. By the same token, you can retrieve registers and push them on top of the stack and do all the arithmetic and necessary operations with them. And finally, control flow. You can compare them. The comparator operations, you see, are less or equal, will push one or zero on top of the stack. Skip is a jump, unconditional jump, that will skip so many dwarf instructions if the top of the stack is, unconditionally. And bra is the conditional branch that will skip so many dwarf instructions if the top of the stack is one. Or zero, I actually forgot. It's been a while since I debugged that code. So what you get is a sort of an embedded assembly language in a place where no one really expects it. And you've got your reverse Polish notation, calculator, stack-based machine. Programming those are fun. I did that when I was very young. James, interestingly enough, also did it when he was very young. But he is much better than me in electronics, that was his path into computer science, which is becoming more and more common. I'm seeing people who started programming microcontrollers before they learned their second language. There are limitations to this. There aren't supposed to be side effects to on memory, and registers are restored, but there are limitations on what can be restored. For example, caller-saved registers will not be restored. Only callee-saved registers would be. There is also a limitation on the stack, which turns out to be immaterial. The bytecode is just so good. You can fit quite a lot of a computation there. You can disassemble Dwarf's bytecode with existing tools, but you can't reassemble them. You can't rebuild those. You do GCC-S, you see bytecode, hex bytes, long sequences of hex bytes dumped whether you compile C or C++. For C, this enables the and C++ exception handler to sail through those sections doing the proper restoration. So we wrote, we designed a language called DwarfScript and wrote an assembler for it. It's called, it's a part of our dynamic patching tool called Katana, which is beyond the limits of the talk. But basically, this the thing gives you a shell with which you manipulate the contents of your ELF binary and replace its dwarf sections with a compiled, assembled dwarf script. So it's a nifty tool. The credit for that goes entirely to James. This is the example of what you may find, may compile with that tool. Here is a CIE. Here are instructions. Here are dwarf operations that will get compiled, and locations and addresses in the ELF space that you can get from the dynamic, from the symbol tables. So we can redirect exceptions. We can find functions and resolve symbols. And we can calculate relocations. But it will be a lot more interesting to do more. So instead of having exception handling stop at a different catch block, which is what all of the above would easily amount to, we want to do arbitrary computations. The problem is that even though the dwarf standard specifies how to do those computations, it doesn't specify when to stop them. You've unwound one frame. You don't have control of whether you want to stop there or go on. That decision is taken by the personality routine, by a C++ exception, specific exception handler unwinder. And this is actually a tight pairing between the GCC and the specific bin utils that you're using. So after working through a whole bunch of old GCC blog posts and obsolete ABIs that tried to cover the topic, you get to manipulate this. GCC exception table is language-specific data, and that language-specific data actually specifies whether this frame contains a handler that can handle this exception or not. So this is how you can stop or continue executing your dwarf snippets that you put in the per-frame stack unwinding routines. Yeah, this is actually the best kind of documentation you can get. The parts before the hashes is what gets emitted by an assembler. It is completely unreadable. The part after the hash is the comment added by verbose ASM, which kind of sort of explains what this means and why it's there. Of course, you need to understand the exception handling model in order to make anything of it. So it is a pretty complex data structure, as it turns out. You can have several language-specific data areas in your program. Some of them for C, some of them for C++, others for Fortran, if you care. Each one will expand into a call site table, an action table, and a type table. And as you can imagine, the call site table merely corresponds to a symbol, offset, extent, and the location of the appropriate catch block. The type information is used to match the type of exceptions. Of course, it is typed in C++ or Java. Of course, those, and by the way, those structures play a large role in Java, which will be interesting. And then you have this loop in which the stack is unwound. So the personality routine is called from a throw statement, unwind raise exception in libgcc, and it unwinds one frame, and then calls the calling dwarf and performing dwarf instructions. Then it calls the personality routine, which interprets a language-specific part, which decides basically whether unwinding should stop and a catch be jumped to and execution continue. Or if not, the handler loops again and unwinds some more frames using dwarf bytecode, one more frame using dwarf bytecode, and checks whether that frame can be caught. And that's how it goes. So with the dwarf script, you can program and emit the contents of that LSDA, language-specific data area, as well. This is what it looks like, actions, identifiers, call sites. And what you end up with is a backdoor that gets activated on a thrown exception. And with the crafted exception table, you control where it stops and where the control goes. So why not make the control go to exec with bin bash -p? All without modifying any data. So, but let's say that there is ASLR in there. And so we don't actually know where the exec V is. But that's no problem, because the dynamic linker knows. So the information is a dynamic segment. We can interpret the dynamic segment exactly the way the dynamic linker itself does, only from Dwarf. Dwarf is very good at referencing memory, fetching things onto the stack, computing with them, coming up with the address of the symbol. So this is the beginning of our dynamic linker, and you see some literals pushed on the stack. You see dereferences. You see arithmetic, and you know what else do you need? Into a GCC accept table, we sneak the literal string for this demo. But of course, you can transform that string as well, because your stack machine is sharing the stack with the main program. So you can construct that string rather than just bringing it along. And here is the fake symbol entry for execvp, which our dynamic linker will resolve. There is one problem, though. On x86-64, the calling convention specifies passing of arguments in registers, and those registers are not Kali saved. So dwarf implementations would actually refuse to install them. This one may fail one way or another, but it generally fails. So let's put those arguments into other registers. And then, since we can resolve any symbol, we can resolve any gadget in the standard library. That makes us dependent on the version of that library, but ASLR doesn't come into play here. Code mutation would. So here we find a gadget that puts R12, RBX, and R14 into RDX, RSI, RDI, the standard ones. And we know where that gadget is because we already resolved the symbol. And so, shell. So far, this is not corrupted any ELF or dwarf data structures. Those are perfectly well-formed data structures that we snuck in there from the point of view of the formats or GCC. However, this is not at all the most defensively coded part of the runtime. In fact, there are overruns, buffer overruns. So even though dwarf instructions are not supposed to affect memory, well, they do write memory. They do write foot passes for the stack of the stack machine. And so where that stack is and how far past the end you can go, well, that's actually hackable. And you can get a synthetic instruction that allows you to do a write primitive. And we have not yet explored this fully. Neither have we explored a standard memory corruption scenario fully. But you're welcome to join the exploration. Come with us to the mines of Moria, right? We're looking for suggestions on what to call orc in this vaguely Tolkienish tribute. So we managed to assemble some missing documentation on the GCC exceptions session, and you know, as the tool is easy to find, I would once again want to state that we're standing here on the shoulders of great researchers who provided the inspirations for the talk. Inspirations. In particular, Julian Vinaig and the Iresi crew, the Grog, Nurgle, Scape. Pax is a fantastic piece of software that has anticipated so many attacks. And it will likely be not vulnerable to this one, but on which of which we can speak offline. And with that, thank you.
Yeah, I'm Rick Farrow. Sergey, yes, when you're running the video,
yes.
Did you create a set user ID shell, so that's what you were executing?
Yes, of course this is a gimmick, because you know, you're executing, well, it's kind of fun to show that hash symbol.
It's true, okay. But the trick was then to execute some arbitrary program.
Yes, you're exactly. Let me tell you more. EHFrame is normally not writable, which is why this is not an exploit technique. But it is actually, it is not a ready exploit technique, but it is actually writable in a bunch of older software and in a bunch of older Java-based machines. Yes. So there are real vulnerabilities out there that this can be used to exploit unless protected by something like PAX that makes other arrangements. For example, one thing that would break our own dynamic linker is, well, breaking the system's own dynamic linker, or breaking it in concert with the system's runtime, but so that we can't emulate it just so easily.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm, sure.
One more time.